Hey, Joe. I'm Tim, an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 30th, 2007. I was 53 years old when I came to my very first AA meeting. I couldn't avoid it another minute, I don't think, and I picked up a white chip, and I still have that same white chip. So that's my story. If I'd come in a year or two or 10 or 20 years earlier, I may have several white chips, but as it was, I was worn out. And AA eventually saved my life. And certainly from that moment, I stopped dying and started living. So, and that first night I got the white chip, I met my sponsor, Tim Moore. He gave me a big book out of the literature cabinet there. He said, keep it simple. When you get home, get on your knees, ask your higher power with strength not to drink, get you through the night. I said, I've been praying. It doesn't work. And he said, no, just keep it simple. Just do exactly what I'm telling you to do. Don't do anything more. And then after you say your prayers, get in the bed, open up the big book, and start reading it. So I said, what I got to lose? I climbed into bed after I asked my higher power for the strength not to drink. Opened up the big book. And, you know, the night before and for months and months before that, I had to drink myself to sleep. I'd pass out every night. And that night I read one paragraph and boom, I was unconscious. So I woke up with a big book on my chest and so I felt something. Maybe it was osmosis, but I got on my knees when I woke up, not having a hangover. I thank that same higher power for the strength not to drink. And so that's been a little over 17 years. If I don't do it every day, I try to do it every day. I try to make, you know, sometimes I jump out of bed and ricochet rabbit out of the house. And sometime during the day, I thank my higher power, which today is God. It's quite simple to say three-letter word, God. But thank God for the last 24 hours without a drink and ask for another 24 hours. I like to say the AA prayers. You know, I didn't have a prayer when I came into AA. I mean, I couldn't say grace at the dinner table, nor had any desire to. The big book, the way they presented the prayers to me, it took the critic out of the process. My critical brain. I just went along with the program. Felt like I didn't work the step until I memorized that prayer. You know, and a lot of times it was a simple prayer, like third step prayer. I had a psychological, emotional block, spiritual block for sure. Didn't feel worthy of what the program offered, really. I didn't think I'd suffered enough at that point. I had to get on my knees with the big book for quite some time, you know, maybe 3 weeks. I thought it was a long time then. Every day seemed like an eternity. I finally did finish the third step prayer. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But again, Tim Moore is my sponsor. His sponsor is a guy named Ken Horvat. These guys are real sober and they don't care about their anonymity as much as some do, I guess. Or at least, I hope that's okay, Tim. Ken Horvat had a sponsor when I first got sober who was at 8111. And I thought it was too late for me coming in at 53. I'm looking around and, you know, people my age had 20 years and all this stuff. And I'm like, you know, I was a newcomer. Tim thought it might be a good idea for me to go meet Papa Bill. And Papa Bill, if you haven't ever heard of him, he was 63 years old when he got his white chip. He lived to be 93, I believe, or even longer, and sponsored hundreds, if not thousands, of guys. So when Tim took me up to meet him, I got him confused with another famous Bill. I thought it was Bill Roop I was going to meet, and it turned out to be Papa Bill. And he was kind of like Yoda, you know, he's sitting there, walk in, he's cosmic. I mean, and he said, well, welcome to the program, Tim. Are you happy, joyous, and free? And I said, well, not yet, but I want to be. And at least I had a little willingness at that time. And I really had a desire to be happy, joyous, and free. And Tim, on the way home, said, well, if you want to be happy, joyous, and free, busy on these steps. I said, okay, yeah, let's give it a shot. And he was a very gentle sponsor. If he'd have been a hard ass, I don't know if it had worked out. Maybe I would have been fine with a hard ass. But Tim's an easygoing guy. He just became a spiritual friend. Always told me what he did with his own sobriety. He never preached to me and told me what I ought to do, per se. He let me make my own mind up. Certainly, he led me to the water a lot of times. So thank you, Tim. May I pause for a quick prayer? As suggested on the page 86 of the big book. God, please direct our thinking tonight so that those thoughts are divorced of self-pity, dishonesty, self-will, self-seeking, and fear. God, inspire our thinking, decisions, and intuitions. Help us all to relax and take it easy. Free us from doubt and indecision. Guide us and show us our next step. God, please help me find the words to better express thy will. We ask all these things that we be of maximum service to you and our fellows. In the name of the steps, we pray. Amen. I'm a member of the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the Nava Club. And Tim is, he's been there several years before me. We started recording our speakers back, actually before I got there. Somebody was doing it. After I was there about a year or so, they were making coffee and this, that, and the other. They asked me if I would try to record using this CD recording device that nobody seemed to know how to use, and I didn't either. And I made every mistake you could possibly make. Turns out, if you keep it simple, it usually comes out pretty good. So I learned that, and like Wes came up recently, told his story. It's fine recording if you want to go to abluechipspeakers.org. He's there with about a little over 700 other speakers since we started doing that, put up that website. It's not people at NABA that listen to it mostly. It's like people from all over the world just surfing, looking for AA speakers. You know, it's amazing. I'll look up and see how many downloads there were, and after about a week, you know, there'll be like 40, 50 downloads, which is not like some streaming services. You'll look, and if it's Paul McCartney, it's got 1.7 views and stuff, and we're not views, but we're downloads. But 40, 50 downloads, I feel like I'm reaching out to somebody. There's somebody out there getting the benefit of you guys' story. And everybody's got a story. Everybody in AA, if they've been around a while, they've got a story. I was born in Bourne, Massachusetts, the town of Bourne. And my dad was Air Force, so there's Otis Air Force Base was up there on the Cape. But technically, I was raised in the South. My early childhood, we lived in California, Arizona, and then we went to Taegu, Korea. We were one of the first families, U.S. military families, to be in South Korea. We were there 2 years, and then he got a big promotion. He was a captain and a jet pilot, and he taught Korean pilots how to fly American jets to control, you know, patrol the DMZ. Between North Carolina and North Carolina.
President Biden. Go away.
South Korea and North Korea. Sorry about that. No political thing at all. I felt really bad for him the other night. Well, we went to Japan after about 6 weeks. He had an oxygen system failure, and his plane crashed. So I just finished the first grade, and it was the day before my sister's third birthday, and they came and knocked on the door. His watch and his wedding ring, and they were warped from the fire. And they gave them to my mother, and everything was different after that. Within a week, we were back in America, and my mother was from Columbus, Georgia, so she didn't want to be going back to her hometown right away. So we went to Montgomery, Alabama, because there's an Air Force base there in Montgomery. There were Air Force wives that were there that she wanted to, you know, for them to support, you know, be within a group of gals that would help her through that, the mourning process. My mom was from Columbus, Georgia, and her dad owned a barbecue joint steakhouse that was like the best place to eat in Columbus on Victory Drive. Fort Benning, some of the folks like Betty Davis, some of the stars would come and have steaks there. And all the cops in town ate free. And they had car hops out front with leather jackets with stars on their shoulders and chains hanging off. And they used a lot of makeup. And it was a cool place. They had a great jukebox. When I got there, the Beatles had just come out. So they had the Beatles. They had the Beach Boys. They also had Patsy Cline and all the country western guys. And it was a great environment to be a grandson there. Now, his family, my dad's family, he was a Methodist minister, and he was the general secretary of the Methodist Church in Mississippi for 30 years. Completely different scenario. My dad had been an Eagle Scout. He played tight end at Auburn when he was a senior. Chuck Jordan had his first year. Had a real solid career in football. I used to tell it that they won everything. Well, they didn't. The year before Chuck Jordan came on board, they lost every game. 0-10 season. And then Chuck came in, and it was 5-5. And then my father graduated. But Vince Dooley was just coming up as a quarterback, and he was there for the success that Chuck would have. He was on the rocket team with Air Force. He was a great pilot. He taught a lot of people how to fly American hardware. When we got back, he was buried at Vicksburg Cemetery. And so they had a 21-gun salute, a flyover, quite a moving ceremony. My uncle, who was 14 years old at the time, he came up to me and put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "Timmy, you're now the man of the house. You got to take care of your mom and your little sister." And I was like 6 1/2 years old. I said, "Yeah, I'll get right on that, sure." Didn't really know what all that meant, but I could feel the pressure, and I certainly didn't feel I was up to it. Reality was kind of harsh, and so I kind of lived in, you know, my imagination would get carried away. I think the first summer we went to stay with my grandparents in Jackson, Mississippi. They let me watch a episode of Gunsmoke, the Western TV show, and the guy that was hung, one of the characters, they hung him in it. I mean, I was 6 1/2 years old, and I was convinced, wow, how'd they do that, you know? Because I didn't think the guy really hung. He was an actor. I wasn't that gullible. So I wonder how he pulled it off. So I went to my grandfather's workshop, and he had the perfect rope to make a noose. And so I put another loop, and I put it up under my arms inside my and then put my shirt over it. And I had the noose coming up out of. You guys are going to think I'm a nut for telling this story, but this is how I became the black sheep of the Ridgway family. My grandfather built a tree house. And it was the Leave It to Beaver tree house of all. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, his carpentry skills were excellent. I was up there playing around with the noose, and I decided to tie it to a limb. And then I swung it with the rope under my arms, and my grandmother came out to tell me it was time for lunch. And I'm just swinging in the tree with my eyes closed. And she went down. She fainted. And she wasn't an old woman at that point, but she was a lot older after she came to. I called up to her. I said, I'm okay. I'm just kidding. And she was like, out. And I had to go get down, and I go get some water, and I pat her face with a washcloth. And she opened her eyes, and she oh, man, she wore my ass out. And then she always looked at me the way, like, what are you going to do next? I can't blame her, you know, being an adult now, looking back on that. But so I was the black sheep, and I was the oldest of all the grandchildren. So they were worried as more grandchildren kept popping up. They were like, no, we're not doing that again. So those poor kids were, they had some strict upraising. But I was raised in Columbus, Georgia, and I'd spend my summers in Jackson. A lot of kids, you know, would smoke rabbit tobacco, you know, out in the woods. And I was one of those kids. And then my mother was a little careless with her cigarettes. She smoked Parliament, recess filter. And I'd grab a few cigarettes, and I'd go to the campfire, and we'd smoke cigarettes. But I was, like, inhaling and getting off on the cigarette from, like, 9 years old. My friends would go, you need to watch it, man. You're going to get hooked. You're going to get addicted to these things. I'm going, nah, I can handle it. They were right. I was smoking a pack to two packs a day in fourth grade. And I smoked up until I was about 45 years old. I'd go on the light. Now, I put them down for a little bit, but somehow I always came back to tobacco. That was my first true addiction. You can't be 10 years old smoking cigarettes like that without lying, and without cheating, and without stealing. And I'm guilty of all of that. I'd go to football practice with a pack of crush-proof marbles in my shoulder pads. I'd stop in the woods on the way home to have a couple of smokes, you know. I knew better, but I just decided that today I'm going to smoke. Maybe I won't tomorrow, but I always did smoke the next day. So that's how I got started. Doing all these, that's how my character defects were formed. And so I was primed to be an alcoholic once I realized alcohol, what it could do. When I was 18 years old, it was December 30th, whatever year that was, I guess it was right about 1971, state of Georgia lowered the drinking age to 18. It was just for me, just for my brother. I'd been drinking for years with a fake ID, but man, I had my own ID. I could go in anywhere, and of course I did. So in high school, I went to Sandy Springs High School. There was a tree house that was behind my girlfriend's house, and her little brother, they would hang out in this tree house. And they talked me into being their bootlegger and dope dealer when I was 16, and they were 12. And they could come up with some coin, man. They'd go through their parents' stuff. I mean, they'd give me a pail of money on Friday, and I'd drop off cases of beer and a bottle of rum and orange juice and a bag of ice and pot and God knows what was going around. This poor kid. I never really worried about what was going to happen to him. But he financed my romance. We, you know, his big sister and I had a big time, you know, for a couple of years. I had a demodified dragster in high school. All the things that terrify me today, I see somebody like that. Oh, Lord, you know, save us from it. And, you know, I did a lot of drag racing, and I went to UGA. Somehow I did really good on my SAT. You know, I really didn't have the grades to get in, but my SAT scores were up there. And I went to University of Georgia in 1971. And there, I found out that if I used RJS Black Beauties to study with, I could really shorten the time necessary to prepare for exams. And I drank beer while I was studying, because somebody had told me that if you take your test on beer, if you've been studying on beer, you'll remember what you did. And it worked. I mean, for some reason, I could do all this bad stuff and I would end up on the honor roll. And I graduated with honors and I went to journalism school. Boy, it would have been a whole lot better if I had worked steps. I give it to you. I mean, I was handicapped by not understanding or knowing what the steps teaches. And I went straight into journalism and worked hard for a long time and didn't make a whole lot of money. And then I took the advertising education that I learned from, and I got in. I was right in the opening wave of the computer business, and so I just happened to be at the right time at the right place with the right guy, and we started a company called MicroMart. It's no longer in existence, but we, you know, for 4 or 5 years, it was one of those meteoric successes. Our last year in business, I think we did about $150 million at a 30% margin, and we were the cheapest guys out there. They called us the gray market whores of the industry. But we were real happy with our 30%. We had 37 stores around the Southeast. We had a mail order business. We had a distributing company. And then we ticked off IBM. And IBM cut us, and we went into, we went major bankruptcy, owing everybody. That was stark and real, you know, watching all these people. You know, they thought we could do no wrong, and all of a sudden they were just going, "You guys, we believed in you." And now look. That fueled my drinking for a little while longer, but I stayed in the computer business, and I worked for some real computer companies that were doing, you know, networking and some advanced stuff. And not that I knew any of that stuff, but I knew the buzzwords. And I was, you know, I was a productive sales guy. I made a good living for a few years. And drinking alcohol was part of the deal, you know. Just, you know, all my, you know, take the clients out, do all that. 3 o'clock, beer 30, send $50 to the beer store, get as many cases as you can. And everybody's knee-walking drunk by the time they get in their cars to drive home or drive to the bar. I mean, it was crazy. And I was going to write a book, but I never did because I really didn't want to publish it. But I had the title, and it was Sex, Drugs, and IBM. And it was a pretty wild time. So I had numerous jobs and adventures while drinking professionally. Somewhere in that haze of stuff, I decided I wanted to be an Air Force pilot. And I went to the recruiter, and he said, "Well, you know, how old are you?" I said, "I'm 26. He said, "Well, you know, the cutoff date is 27. If you're going to," I said, "Well, I got to go to OCS." He said, "Why?" And I said, "I've got a degree." He goes, "What is a degree in what?" And I said, "Journalism." And he's like, "That is very good, but nothing like, we're not interested in any journalist in the Air Force." And I said, "Well, my dad was a pilot. I really want to be like my dad." He said, well, do you have any DUIs? I said, well, I have two. And he said, you have two? Well, you're out. There's no way possible. And I said, well, what if I get some letters of recommendation? And he said, well, you know, suit yourself. You know, you could try. You know, it's that chance. You know, he thought that was the end of me. At the University of Georgia, I was in a fraternity, and Herman Talmadge was in my fraternity. And he was Senator of Georgia. He had sent me a letter when I was initiated, welcoming me to the fraternity. So I photocopied that and wrote him this really glowing letter about how it was my destiny to be an Air Force pilot, like my dad. They rubber stamped it, sent the letter right back on gold embossed letterhead. So I said, well, that's one letter. And then Sam Nunn was our other senator, and he was chairman of the Armed Forces Committee. So I said, well, that wouldn't hurt. So I took Herman's letter, photocopied it, and sent him a letter with that. And within a week, I got a letter back. So I had two senators, Georgia senators, recommended me. And Jimmy Carter had just been elected to the White House. So I sent both those letters to Jimmy Carter. And man, what a letterhead that came in. It was gold. Took up half the page, you know, the big spread eagle. Jim Ridgway would make a fine candidate. So I spent, they tried everything they could to wash me out. They threw every test at me, and I passed them. And they said, well, you got to take the vision test. And I said, I'm 20/20, you know, we can skip that. They said, well, you'll have to take it before you go in. And I said, okay. So I go down to Warner Robins, the last test. And it turns out I have astigmatism, which explained why I never could return mean tennis serve. I mean, I just never saw the ball. I mean, I saw it, but it wasn't where I was swinging the racket. They said, you cannot land on an aircraft carrier. I said, well, this is the Air Force, not the Navy. I said, don't argue with us, but you can be an officer, and you could be a navigator. You can sit right up there next to the pilot. And I'm like, I don't think so. So I went to the package store. I'd already said goodbye to my wife for 6 months to go to basic training at OCS. And I show up, knee-walking drunk, without a call. And we didn't have cell phones. That's my excuse. I didn't have a cell phone, honey. They hadn't been invented yet. You know, she was like, well, what are we going to do now? I mean, that's all you talked about for a year. And I said, well, think of something. I wasn't ready to get sober, that's for sure. And I went through many jobs. I drank myself through Micromart, Bulldog Computer Products, Universal Data Consultants, CompUSA, PMSI, which is Project Management Services Incorporated. And for there, I was on projects for Liberty Mutual and Halliburton Energy. And I worked at dozens more companies. Alcohol was just like taking vitamin supplements, you know. I drank every day. One day, a year before 2007, I was taking care of my mother. She was an advanced diabetic. Very complicated case, and she was crying one day, and I said, what's wrong? And she goes, I can't depend on you. If I have an insurrection, what are you going to do? I can't wake you up. You're passed out. I was like, so I had sufficient enough fortitude to just white knuckle it, and without going to AA, I got on my knees, and I did pray. I said, God, please, help me not to drink. And after a few weeks, the cravings went away. And so I would look in the mirror and I'd say, you got willpower. God was not even in the picture anymore because I'm in control of this thing here. You know, you don't have to drink because you've got willpower. And that lasted a while. Now, I still kept my same playmates. And I would go to the bar, and they would drink, and I would like have a club soda and a lime or something, and I was miserable. I said, well, maybe you can drink. You know, I romanced it. You know, I said, maybe you can drink like other people. This time it'll be different. Well, it was different because I never got sober for like 4 months. I was in a blackout drunk the whole time. I'd gone so long without alcohol, when I reintroduced it to my body, I just went into one blackout and stayed in for 4 or 5 months. And that's when I met Tim, you know. And I wouldn't even met him, but my sister came by to just check on me. She was like, he's acting kind of weird. And said, how you doing? I said, not good. She said, what's wrong? And I said, I can't stop drinking. I didn't know she was Al-Anon. She'd been in wait for me to say I needed help. And that's when she took me to our first AA meeting. It was at the NAVA Club at the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting. Now, the speaker's name was David C. And he's telling his story. And I'm going, he looks familiar. But man, I don't remember him looking that clean cut. I mean, he was wearing a nice jacket, haircut, skin tone was good, no blemishes. He starts talking about the treehouse in Sandy Springs. And, you know, you hear, well, I went to a lot of AA meetings, but I finally heard somebody tell my story. Well, I went to one AA meeting, and I was in the story. And his sponsor was Bill Sanders. Bill Sanders was the chairman of the Atlanta Men's Workshop for decades. And it was Doc Crandall's sponsee who started the, was another fine fellow that for some reason his name escapes me. But in the whole story, Dave's talking about Bill Sanders this, he did this, and you know, it's so important to have a really good sponsor. And so I pick up a white chip, and he goes, Tim Ridgway, how long have you been out? I'm like, out? What does that mean? He says, well, this is not your first white chip. It couldn't be. Not you. And I said, no, this is it. This is my very first AA meeting. He goes, oh, all that stuff I said about sponsorship does not apply to me. I cannot be your sponsor. I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. I didn't really know what it meant. I just knew I didn't want to drink. And he said, but my sponsor, he's got too many sponsees right now, but he will be glad to talk to you. I was like, okay, give me his number, you know, what I got to lose. And I didn't know Bill was like a WSB phenom, you know, he's like a world famous guy. I got his voicemail, and I recognized his voice. And I'm like, hey, Bill, this is Tim Ridgway. David gave me your number. I picked up a white chip last night. Call me back if you want to. But his voicemail said, well, sorry, I'm not available, but have a really great day unless you have other plans. So I just hung up the phone. And but before I get my hand away from the receiver, the phone rings. And it's Tim Ridgway? Yes. Bill Sanders. Hi, Bill. How you doing? Great. He goes, great. You pick up a white chip the night before, and the next morning you're great. I didn't know AA worked like that. And I said, no. I'm not great at all. I'm sorry. He says, yeah, you just told me what you thought I wanted to hear. And I said, yeah. And he says, no, we want to talk about the truth. Are you willing to talk about the truth? That was a big moment at that time. He did most of the talking. So I didn't have to lie much because he did. But everything he said, I wrote down. I mean, I literally wrote, I mean, I took notes, like my life depended on it, which it did. He asked me if I'd met anybody. I said, well, this guy gave me a big book. He seemed like a pretty nice guy. I think his name's Tim, too. And he said, oh, okay. You talking about Tim Warren? I said, yes, I guess. And he said, well, if that's who you're talking about, You could do worse. You could do a lot worse. I kept going back to the Monday night speaker meeting. And you had a speaker recently, Tinsley E. He was telling his story the second Monday. And I was a big fan of his because not only could he play the guitar great, he could chug a Heineken with the foam coming down his finger and play slide with dripping and not miss a beat. He was my hero, a rock hero. He was standing there, I think he had, 9 years sobriety at that time or something. He tells his story, and I said, well, you know, if he can do it, maybe I can do it. I was kind of like thinking, maybe I got a chance here. God's grace, I came willing to gradually become teachable. On the first step, I went through the big book. I didn't read the 12 and 12 my first time around. The big book got me sober, and I think the 12 and 12 has kept me sober. I like what it says about the first step. The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice AA program unless they have hit bottom. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can dream of taking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares anything about a higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry an AA's message to the next sufferer? No, the average alcoholic, self-centered and extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. Under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Then and only then do we become as open-minded to conviction and as willing to listen as a dying can be. I stood ready to do anything which will lift the merciless obsession from me. Second step, I wasn't sure if I came to believe. Those first few days, I just knew that I wanted to believe. I finally said, okay, I'm going to do this thing in my best ability. I got a long story about the third step. I'm going to skip that tonight. But it involved me stealing hot dogs at Quick Trip. And I have a dollar in my pocket leaving a meeting. And I'd go and I'd sneak a second wiener. Not see-through. Styrofoam containers. Get it right, Tim. Mm-hmm. They're styrofoam. And I could get that extra wiener in there. And the first time I was hungry. And then after that, I knew the secret. So, I did it. And I kept having to say the third step prayer because I was stealing hot dogs. And then one day I walked in and it was a see-through container and there was no place to put the second wiener. 3 days of not stealing hot dogs, I got the third step prayer. Maybe not word for word, but I knew what it meant and I was ready to do the fourth step. And thank God, Tim was real patient during that time. We got on our knees and did the third step prayer at NABA in the office, read it right out of the book. And I'd been on a bicycle riding because I'd lost my cars. I didn't stretch or anything. And I got straight to my knees and I have a vicious leg cramp. Well, we're holding hands and I keel over. And I'm flopping like a fish and he's like trying to let go of my hand. I'm not letting it go. And he's going, we don't have to do this thing. I told you, an easy guy. And I said, no, I want to. Somehow I survived that and did the fourth step. Today I was a discussion leader and we talked about the sixth and seventh step. Should have been there because I'm not going to talk about it now. And I got one last prayer. I got from Larry Scott. Larry Scott does a thing called The Big Book Comes Alive. And he's spoken at NABA several times. He works with people all over the country doing Charlie Stott type weekends at churches and stuff. So I borrowed this prayer. It's an old-timer's prayer. And I'm not an old-timer. I'm 17 years. It's got to be 20 years to be an old-timer, but let's pretend. God, keep me from thinking I must share in every meeting, no matter the topic. Keep my mind free from the recital of endless details and give me wings to get to the point. remind me to guard confidences, keep still when I feel it is necessary to speak up for someone's own good. Release me from the need to straighten out everybody else's thinking and program. God asks for the grace to listen to newcomers. Please help me to remember the patience with which others listened to me when I was new. Please seal my lips and give me advice, and help me to remember to share only my experience, strength, and hope. Remind me that my purpose is to fit myself to be a maximum service to you and to the people around me. Help me to remain teachable. Teach me again the lesson that occasionally is possible that I may be wrong. And remind me, please, of the freedom that I gain when I'm able to promptly admit I am wrong and make amends when necessary. Help me to remember the difference between making amends and just saying, I am sorry. Help me to be a worker among workers, a friend among friends. Please keep me from being a bleeding deacon, and help me to walk the path towards being an elder statesman. Keep me ever mindful. I cannot manage my own life through my own unaided will. I know that I'm not a saint. Please show me the way to seek you, so that I may continue to grow along spiritual lines. Remind me, please, of Rule 62, to not take myself so damn seriously. It's so easy to take myself way too seriously. Keep me free of gossip, character assassination, and judgment. Remind me that I'm not perfect, even though I've humbly asked that my character defects be removed. My shortcomings still arise unexpectedly, causing damage to others and to myself. Help me to walk with faith and acceptance, to see good things in unexpected places and talents in unexpected people, and give me the grace to tell them so. Help me to see that you love each of your children and that you do not need my opinion of them or suggestions on what they might deserve. Thank you very much. Amen. And God, please help me help other people. And if there are those I cannot help, please help me do them no harm. Amen. I hope I was useful to at least one person tonight. Thank you, AA, for my sobriety.
All right. Thank you, Tim.
Hill got flat and now I won't have to about it no more. Somehow, someway, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.